welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with producer Jason DeFilippo. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most brilliant and interesting people and turn their wisdom into practical advice that we can use to impact our own lives and those around us. Today, one of the most prolific authors of our time, 18 international bestsellers. He blogs every single day on one of the most popular blogs anywhere in the internet. I've known Seth Godin for years now, and if you've ever had or overheard a conversation about marketing, you can't go more than a few minutes without someone quoting Seth Godin. If you dig deep enough into Seth's work, you can see his influence all over corporate and startup culture, as well as publishing and even education. You all requested Seth so many times that I flew out to his office in New York to do this interview. Of course, talking with an old friend is always a good time, and it was a lot of fun to hear his thoughts on how to stand out in a crowd, do something that lights you up and is profitable and valuable to others at the same time. Seth's thinking is really on another level, and if you're not familiar with his work, then this episode will really shake up the way you think about your work life and what you bring to the world. If you want to know how we've got such great guests here on the show, yeah, the numbers speak for themselves. I wish that were true. It's about the network. It's about systems and tiny habits. It's about outreach and maintaining those connections. I'm teaching you how to do that for free over at 6-Minute Networking. JordanHarbinger.com/course is where you can find that. And by the way, most of the guests here on the show actually subscribe to the course in the newsletter. So come join us and you'll be in some pretty smart company. All right, here's Seth Godin.
So you're viewed as a successful person as far as your work is concerned. I don't know much about your personal life, but rather than starting with your successes, which I'll include, of course, in the introduction, I would love to start with some failures, because I think people look at successful people like you and they go, this is a guy I never had to worry about much. You know, he's successful and he's been successful. And as far as Google is concerned, he's always been that way.
Okay. I mean, I am averse to the failure Olympics, because I think sometimes it gives us a place to hide, but there are two kinds of failures. I have failed more times than anyone who's watching this in terms of projects brought forward that didn't resonate. When I was a book packager, I got 800 rejections in a row. And for more than 10 years, I was on the edge of bankruptcy, 4 weeks away from being completely out of money. When we were building Yoyodyne, the company that ended up going to Yahoo, our biggest client was AOL. And at one point, the VP of AOL said to me on the phone, if you set foot on our campus, I will have you arrested.
Oh, wow.
Right? So it was high stakes. And there are things that I brought, you know, books I worked on for a year that sold 1,000 copies. There were projects, you know, another thing we did for AOL was one of the best ideas I ever had. We worked on it for a year. We built the whole thing out. And a week before it launched, AOL switched its business model from royalty to flat rate, which meant the project got canceled.
Ugh.
And so there's a lot of bumper cars when you decide to do a life of projects. And I wouldn't have it any other way. The real failure that I think is worth talking about, that's way more interesting now that I've survived the other kind, mm-hmm. is the failure of inaction. And like everyone, I have a really long list of that. What are the things I could have done and didn't? Who are the people I could have helped but didn't? And that's the kind of thing I try to pay attention to, because I know a lot of people who have succeeded. And the reason they succeeded is because they persisted, but also because they protected against the downside. So they still protect against the downside. But what could they have accomplished if they had protected a little bit less against the downside and instead said, it doesn't matter that this might fail. What matters is that this is worth trying. And that's something I try to motivate myself to do all the time.
When you see people protecting against the downside, what are you primarily referring to? Is there kind of a common example of people being overly risk averse? Or,
well, the most important good way to protect against the downside is you never want to get thrown out of the game. And so the reason I can confidently say I failed more than most people is because I haven't gotten thrown out of the game. I got to keep trying.
Yeah.
I did thousands of book ideas and published 120 books as a book packager. And only three of them became big bestsellers. That means I had 117 that disappointed the publisher, right? Stay in the game. Make it so that you're not thrown out. But the thing that people avoid is the one-star review on Yelp, the person in the audience who doesn't laugh at your talk, the engagement with a customer who's furious at you. well, maybe it's not for them. And if you have a way to make promises that aren't disingenuous, that don't undermine your reputation, and then you can make people whole when it doesn't match, well, then fine, it's not for you. And so if somebody goes to a horror movie and it's too scary, just give the guy his $9 back. Mm-hmm. Don't feel like you shouldn't have made it. I have a podcast coming out about, for whatever reason, I talk about Stanley Kubrick a lot. 2001 was trashed by the critics when it came out, that it was boring, that it was poorly made. So what should Kubrick have done? Pulled it from the theater? Of course not.
Gone to work at Blockbuster.
Yeah. Right? But you make the movie knowing some people aren't going to like it. If you want everyone to like what you do, you can't even open like an ice cream stand because people are allergic to ice cream.
Yeah. What did you do to almost get have the threat of being arrested at AOL? I mean.
Okay. So the AOL story works like this. I invented with my team at Yo9 commercial email. If you've ever gotten an email you wanted to get, that's because we invented it. It was 1990, long before the web. And we ran games of skill and sweepstakes using email because there was no World Wide Web. So one of our big clients was AOL. One of our big clients was Carter Wallace, the people who make Arid Extra Dry deodorant. And so if you were playing the Arid Extra Dry deodorant game, you got an email every week. And if you got the questions right, you moved up in the standings. And at the end, you would win, I don't know, a car or something. If you were playing the AOL game, you were getting emails every week about parts of AOL that you could go research on AOL and have fun and win a prize. Well, Monday, the emails went out. And for whatever reason, the AOL players, there were 400,000 of them, got the Arid Extra Dry email by mistake.
Oh, oops. Yeah.
And this was when AOL stock was going up every day. So, not good. No. Not good. And so I had this long, long, distraught meeting with my tech people, and they built all this stuff. And a week later, I get to the office, and they'd done it again.
Oh, yeah.
And so I called down to Virginia, which is where AOL was, and I said, Audrey, that was the vice president, I can't tell you how sorry I am. I'm going to fly down there just to express my concern. I'm really sorry. And that's when she threatened to have me arrested if I showed up on campus. So we then hired at great expense this guy, we got him to quit his job, 50-year-old, who was grown up, who would build a whole system. And then third week, I get to the office at 4 a.m. because no email at home, right? 4 a.m., check it, and it's mixed up again.
No.
And I called Dan, my head of engineering in our Boston office. And if it hadn't been a basement office, he would have jumped out the window. It turns out what this guy had built was a system that showed just four of us what was about to happen. So only four people got the email the third week, and then it was fixed after that. But yeah.
I'm getting anxiety hearing it.
Exactly.
So I can imagine
telling it.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you've had a bunch of failures. And the failure Olympics, I'm with you on that. I feel like there are people now who are just like, here's this even bigger let me one up your story about that. And exactly. This thing I almost did to myself on purpose so that I had a story for your podcast. Yeah. I get that. Do you ever have imposter syndrome these days, or is that kind of a thing that you've put behind you?
Yeah. So for those people who haven't heard the term, imposter syndrome applies to both sexes, genders, but women in particular feel it, which is, I'm a fraud. What right do I have to be on the stage? What right do I have to be publishing this idea or running this podcast? And I have really strong feelings about this, and some people are made uncomfortable by it, but here we go. Of course you're an imposter. Of course you feel that way. What right do you have to be sure that you can define the future? You can't. If you don't feel insecure, you're a psychopath.
Yeah.
Right? The fact is, when you feel like an imposter, it means you're onto something. It means you're leaning out of the boat doing generous work. If you're not feeling that way, you're not working hard enough.
What does it mean when I simultaneously think, why isn't my work bigger? And also, maybe I shouldn't be leaning out of the boat. I have imposter syndrome and entitlement or something, whatever that's called.
Yeah. And I think they go together because you believe that you were doing something generous. And what we see in our culture is who's number one on YouTube, who's number one on Billboard, who's number one on TV. And they don't mention that there are, 142 TV shows and only one can be number one. They don't mention The average podcast in this country has 145 listeners.
Yeah.
Average.
Yeah.
Your podcast could be great. It is not related to the fact that someone else has more listeners to you. Those are separate things. And there are tactics and strategies that you can use to get more people to see what you do. But the number of people who see what you do is not related to the goodness of what you do.
I think that's important because I know that people, I don't know if it's just an American thing. We're obsessed with charts. We're obsessed with rankings. Everything is competitive. And that's good because it makes the free market a little better. But it's also, there's some part of us that goes, well, if I'm not number one, then I'm garbage or my work is garbage. And that's inherently unhealthy because nobody can start at number one. I mean, not really. Anyway.
Unless you realize that the whole thing is about categories, the taxonomy of what category. So I will never have a number one Billboard single because I don't make music.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Right? Well, if you can invent a category, you get to be number one in it. And I've been doing that my whole career. I was the number one creator of CD-ROMs for parents when I did my Fisher-Price CD-ROM title, because it was the only one.
Right, yeah, sure.
And when I was the first person to do books with Amazon, I was number one in my category.
Good trip.
You don't have to be a pioneer, but the benefit of being a pioneer is you get to invent a category that's very small, and you can be number one in
it. Right. And then you just spend hopefully not too much time looking over your shoulder going, I hope nobody else figures this out.
Or actually, you want everyone else to figure it out. And that's the other thing is that I was at a trade show this weekend in the fancy food industry. And the people who are at the trade show aren't competing with each other, right? There isn't the problem of this chocolate versus that chocolate. The problem is that 99% of the people don't buy any expensive chocolate. That's the competition. Right? The competition is always none of the above. The competition is didn't show up. So right now with the Alt MBA and with the Akimbo workshops, we're trying to reinvent the way people learn. Who is my competition? My competition is cat videos.
Which are pretty compelling depending on who you're asking. But yeah, maybe not the same level of value as somebody who flies here from South Africa to learn from you. I love the idea that school is failing, idea generators, mold breakers, and there's this old model of school because I'm learning more now as an adult than I ever felt like I did as a kid. It makes me a little nervous because now I feel like, oh, I got to make up for lost time. Because if this is what learning was supposed to be like, what the hell was I doing for 27 years in school and then grad school? What should younger people or people in general be doing to maybe improve the way that they educate themselves or improve the way that they learn?
Well, so I use the word education and learning differently.
Yeah.
Education is a management system to get you to comply. There's a prize at the end. There's a certificate. Whereas learning requires enrollment, voluntarily saying, I want to move forward. Mm-hmm. The most important thing we can teach is thirst. The desire to learn. That once you want to learn, the amount of things you can learn goes to infinity because everyone has every course they'd ever need to take right in front of them. The problem is when we try to do it to people against their will.
Sure. Yeah. I don't remember willingly going to, well, after a while, I was just beaten into submission basically. But now I don't have enough time to read all the books that I want. There's not enough time for me to take all the courses that I want online. Or in person, for that matter. I can't get to school fast enough.
But from the time you're 6 or 7, what coaches and teachers say and parents say is, why didn't you get an A? Why didn't you come? Well, no wonder no one wants to play that game. It's stacked against you. That if we could figure out how to create a cycle of, wasn't that fun? That no one learns how to walk or ride a bike from a course, right? We learn how to do it by trying it, failing, and trying again. And so we are born wanting to know that skill. We learn a skill, but then we are brainwashed into stopping.
I think there's also an element of us being brainwashed into thinking we can't do it on our own. I don't remember a whole lot of people, even when I was younger, encouraging me. My parents, of course, but school, it kind of wasn't, hey, research this on your own, figure it out on your own. And I remember the one or two times teachers actually went, well, you're learning how to read on your own. I'm just going to let you do that. It was kind of like, stop reading the first grader's book when you're in kindergarten.
Exactly.
And read this dumb book.
It's compliant.
Yeah.
Right? And the same thing happens to the adults that I put on the spot all the time. And, I told the story last week. When we were building Yogodyne, I was hiring a person a week. And for a small company, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And we would do, I ran a full page ad in the New York Times. 500 people responded. We had two sessions of 100 people each came to hear me give my pitch once, so I wouldn't have to repeat it to every single person. Then we put them into groups of five. And my employees went and sat at each group interview of five to find out if they're people like us. Then they went to a smaller group. So I would sit at a group of people with five, and I'd say, all right, here's the deal. And I had to make it more and more specific because people kept misunderstanding the question. I don't really care about the answer. But if I wanted to know how many gas stations there were in the United States, without you using any outside information, how would you figure it out? And I would say this to the group of five. And every single time, they fell into three categories. One person would take out a pad. Two people would say no to whatever anybody else said. And one or two people would lead. Well, we could do this. What do you think about this? Oh, let's see. There are this many companies that sell gas. How many cars? How many people? That's that person. Then there's the other person who's writing down whatever they say. And then, nah, that's a bit. What else you got? Well, who do you think I hired?
You need a mix, don't you?
Nah.
You don't just want all leaders, do you?
This wasn't really about leaders. It was about curiosity.
Oh, okay.
Because all we were doing as an organization was solving problems that hadn't been solved before. I didn't need people to do repeated tasks. I needed people to solve problems that hadn't been solved before. They could be big or small. Yeah. And if you're afraid of solving a problem without a textbook, without a manual, I can't fight that.
And you probably don't want the person who's naysaying, and you probably don't need the scribe as much. You can find them anywhere.
Now, we had a few of those people. But in general, every time I hired the curious person, I got a curious person. Mm-hmm. And curious people in fast-changing times are the people you want by your side.
Especially somebody who's not afraid to voice an idea in a group where they think that person might also take their job.
Yeah.
That's somebody who's not afraid of a little bit of risk and also doesn't have a scarcity mindset that's going to cause them to unplug someone else's computer or whatever.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Seth Godin. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored in part by Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community with thousands of classes covering dozens and dozens, really, of creative and entrepreneurial skills. They've got photography, creative writing, design, productivity. Jason, didn't they have like chess in there and stuff too?
They've got all sorts of things. I'm actually taking an Adobe Audition course because I've got a project coming up where I have to use Adobe Audition. But since I have Skillshare, I can get up to speed pretty quickly. And I tell you what, the classes are fantastic. They're actually taught by really skilled people
that are sharing their skills. I get it. I see what you did there, Skillshare.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
So I think this is important. Lifelong learning is obviously important to me. It's important to Jason. It's important to most of you all listening as well. So join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today. And we've got a deal for them, Jason.
Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for our listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. That's right. Skillshare is offering the Jordan Harbinger Show listeners 2 months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/Harbinger. Again, go to Skillshare.com/Harbinger to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/HARBINGER.
This episode is also sponsored by Design Crowd. Crowdsourcing is how busy people, especially business owners like myself, get stuff done in the 21st century. And thanks to Design Crowd, you can focus on running your business while handing over the reins for your company's logo, web design, t-shirt, you name it, to a pool of over 715,000. I love how that keeps, every time we do a read, that number increases. 715,000 designers around the world. Design Crowd crowdsources custom work based on your specs, and then you pick the design that you like best. So here's what you do. Go to designcrowd.com/Jordan. You post a brief describing what you want from the art that you need. Design Crowd invites 715,000-ish designers from Sydney to San Francisco to respond. You get a couple designs in the first few hours. Over a week and change, you get 60, 100. I think we got like 300 when we tried this. Different pieces from designers around the world. You pick the ones you like. You approve payment to the designers. And if you don't like any of the designs you get, Design Crowd offers a money-back guarantee. Jason?
Check out designcrowd.com/Jordan. That's designcrowd.com/Jordan for a special $100 VIP offer for our listeners. Or simply enter the discount code Jordan when posting a project on Design Crowd. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard from our amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. Don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode, so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of the key takeaways from Seth Godin. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means you get all the latest episodes downloaded automatically to your podcast player as they're released, so you don't miss a single thing from the show. Now back to our show with Seth Godin.
You bring this idea up in Akimbo. There's an example of these kids getting laptops, and is it right. Africa or
it was
South America?
Tablets. Yeah, Nicholas Negroponte.
And this is fascinating because I'm thinking, I always try to guess where the story is going. I don't know if that's just from watching too many movies or if that's human
curious.
Nature.
Yeah.
And I was wrong. I thought, they're going to get these and they're going to find Candy Crush, and then nothing ever happened and the tablets ran out of batteries and that was the end. Somebody played Candy Crush until they ran out. But that's not what happened.
Right.
So the self-learning process is much different than the bash people into
exactly.
compliant factory workers process.
No one had ever spent time pushing these kids to obey. There was no school. They had never been to school. They were functionally illiterate. They were born to grow up to work in the field. And when Nicholas is the founder of the MIT Media Lab, so he does things that are on the edge and with rigor. And they tracked every single behavior on every one of these tablets. The kids taught themselves to read. They taught themselves to hack the system so they could use the camera and other tools in it. And mostly they taught each other how to use it. Because no one had ever told them not to do those things. And instead of just sitting around doing nothing, they had something to do. The idea of Candy Crush is an opiate. It's designed to take your mind off the noise around you. But if you're not surrounded by this ever-competitive noise, Candy Crush is boring.
Right, yeah.
It's supposed to be boring. It is not boring to learn how to edit Wikipedia, and that's what these kids did.
I'm very impressed that they learned how to do it. I mean, it took me a while to figure out how to edit Wikipedia, right? They certainly don't make it as user-friendly as it probably could be these days. And I think that's a little bit by design, because it makes vandalism a little more difficult.
For sure. So here's the interesting statistic that I just looked up on Wikipedia. 32 million people have a registered account on Wikipedia. 3,900 people are authorized to start a new article in Wikipedia without oversight.
Hmm.
That's the size of the funnel. 1 in 10,000. Meaning that most people who edit Wikipedia simply fix typos. A few thousand people really get deep into it, and 3,800 of them are the actual, quote, staff Wikipedia. That funnel is fascinating because it applies to most forms of everything. When you think about, out of every 30 million people who say, I paint, how many of them are cutting edge artists that belong in the metropolitan or the modern art? It's not a talent thing.
Right.
It's a skill and commitment thing.
That's an important point. I think that's more important than I originally had given it credit for, because a lot of us will say, I can't really do that. I don't have the natural skill, right. Or man, it's going to take me 20 years to build that level of skill.
Yep.
But since that's not the metric we're really required to have to do anything important.
Exactly.
It becomes not irrelevant, but certainly less important and less relevant than we might have thought.
Right. Because most of the things we celebrate in the media and the culture are talents. How mm-hmm. tall are you? Can you dunk a basketball? How fast are you on the buzzer at Jeopardy? These are things that I will argue you might be wired for.
Mm-hmm.
But the other stuff, persistent, open-minded, curious, generous, driven, those things are harder to build a game show around, but that's the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. Those are the people who end up running the rest of our lives, because that's what makes the culture work.
I think we all know it's cheaper for big companies to make, as you said, average things for average people. But now we're seeing all these micro market subcultures, sure. influencers. So there's no Larry King Live anymore. I mean, maybe it exists, but not really in the way that it did in the 90s, right?
Sure.
Where like there were news articles that I read when I do research on people. It says, during Larry King Live, a plane crashed into, and it was like, well, that must have been at 10 p.m. on every weeknight because everyone was watching this.
Yep.
That kind of isn't a thing. And unless it happens during Game of Thrones or something, right? And even then it's like, oh, well, on Tuesday, oh, wait, that's sure. only when I watched it. So late night TV, even those are the big things that people talk about, and those are fragmented, and those are competitive, and those hosts are crying in their cereal about the lack of ratings. And giant shows like Bill Maher or whatever on
HBO. You have a giant show. Your show is bigger than Bill Maher's show.
That's what I learned that recently, and I was like, that's not right. And then I asked people that have the secret inside details, and I went, well, where's my contract with HBO?
Exactly.
Where's my giant sound studio?
Right. Well, theirs is a legacy business.
That's right.
Yours is a growing one. That we could talk forever about the dynamics here, but what happened was the FCC said there's only three channels. That creates scarcity. Everyone's watching TV. That creates this value. The programming was not, how do I get more people to watch TV? It's how do I get them to not watch one of the other two networks? Because the game theory is pretty simple, which is if I get a third, I win. Just a third, that's plenty. And so if you're running a commercial against one third of the American population, you better sell them something they want to buy.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot of people. So you have Heinz Ketchup and Kraft Singles and Ford Motor, right? But then the FCC stops mattering at all. And we go from three channels to Larry King. He actually wasn't as big as it may seem today. He was tiny compared to MASH or to Carol Burnett. Then you go to 100 cable channels. And then you go from 100 cable channels to 1 billion internet channels. If there's 1 billion internet channels, if there's 70 million blogs, if there's 5 million or whatever it is, podcasts, there's no shortage of things to tune into. And by definition, there will be some hits because we like to have something we can buzz about.
Mm-hmm.
But even the hits are tiny compared to what they used to be. That Mad Men, which was considered the greatest TV show of its time, 3 million people tuned in every episode.
Which is like, if your podcast had that, you'd be the one of the top podcasters. But I don't even know if you're beating Rogan at that point.
Right. But if you were on TV in 1970, that was last 3 million. There was no TV show that had fewer viewers than 3 million in 1970.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know.
It was last place because you had a third if you just tied, right? If you just tied, you had 60 million, 50 million, 40 million people watching you.
Wow.
This is 3 million. It's Mad Men because the whole thing fractures. And if the whole thing fractures, number one, it's not clear advertising makes sense. But if advertising does make sense, why on earth would you advertise average stuff when you could buy specific places to put your ads? So if you know that it's a vegan podcast, you can sell them vegan stuff.
Right.
Which you never used to be able to buy an ad for vegan stuff. Where could you afford to do that? So now we're way out on the long tail because it's also true. At the very same time, just a coincidence, container ships plus robots plus computers means we can make obscure edge case products at a reasonable price. So if you think about a product like the Tile, I have one on my keys here, which is this thing that can like help you find your keys if you lose them.
Right, the little Bluetooth dongle or whatever.
In 1970, you could never have afforded to make this because you would have needed to find 40 million people who would go to Kmart to buy one. Because you needed shelf space. Oh, we don't need shelf space. We have Amazon.
Right,
unlimited shelf space. So all these things line up. 3D printer to make the prototype. 3D EEPROM driver, blah, 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 blah. So you don't need to sell that many Tile the first year to be glad you started the company. That was inconceivable in 1970. So all these things lined up at the same time to create this long fractured thing, which means that most ideas are underwater. Most of the songs on iTunes sell zero copies a year. Most of the Kindle books sell zero copies a month. Zero, because it's under the line. There's a whole bunch that sell one. As I said, podcasts have 145 listeners. So you're not going to be able to make a living at it. It's a great hobby. So what we're going to end up with is all this churn at the long tail. And then the short head when the Rogans or whatever show up as a hit. Because hits are harder to find, you can make money from it. And because they're so much cheaper to make, you don't have to make that much money to be glad you did.
So can we make a huge impact like we used to be able to do by getting a hit or creating something and having it resonate with the masses? Like, is it harder now or does it just look harder? Or are we kind of like redefining what hit means?
A hit?
Yeah, I guess that, yeah.
Do you mean...
Change
the culture or do you mean make a lot of money?
Yeah, so is there even a such thing as cultural radar anymore?
We want there to be cultural radar.
Right.
And so there is. And it's not, I watched 40 episodes of Seinfeld. It might just be yada, yada, yada. And there's a whole bunch of people who know what you just said. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a memification of how we talk about it. But what's really happening, and I think we see this beautifully in the way the gay marriage movement succeeded so quickly, is what are your friends doing? People like us do things like this. The people around you, what do you see? And so what they realized was they didn't need to make a case or change everyone's mind. They simply needed to make it so that people who cared about the issue would normalize it enough to the people around them. So even though there wasn't a central broadcast, a central show, it becomes this groundswell of, fine. And so it's done, right? And so we're going to see the culture keep changing horizontally, not the vertical way. The vertical way was Oprah would have somebody on who said something that was heard by 25 million women at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then boom, it's on the radar. Mm-hmm. This is slower than that and more horizontal than that, but it will change the culture because the culture wants to change and people want to be in sync with their people.
That makes sense. And it sort of leads me to what probably sounds like a dumb question, which is, does it still make sense for us to do good work, the high quality work? And of course it does. But it kind of seems like it depends on the measuring stick.
Oh, but
stick
the semantics matter so much.
Yeah.
So let's be clear about what quality means.
Sure.
Quality does not mean deluxeness. Quality does not mean expensiveness. Those words are often associated with quality. Quality, Edward Deming, Phil Crosby, their definition is meets spec. If you meet spec every time, you have created something of quality. So a Toyota is higher quality than a 1968 Rolls-Royce. Because the 1968 Rolls-Royce, made by hand, broke down more than a 1990 Toyota. It was higher quality, met spec. So the production of almost everything in our lives, food chain, the mechanical devices we buy, way higher than any time in history. Because engineers figured out how to improve quality. Okay. Now, if I get a Kindle book and it's filled with typos, it's low quality.
Right.
If I get a Kindle book and it's a trashy romance, well, was it marketed as a trashy romance? Because if it is, then it's a high quality trashy
right.
romance.
Right. It meets spec.
It meets spec. So what does it mean to do good work? Well, I think the difference between good work and great work is that good work met spec. Great work, you can't stop talking about. It so exceeded your expectations that you have to spread the word. And therefore, if we want to have a change in the culture, we have to be remarkable. And what it means to be remarkable is to do something great. That doesn't mean quality. It might mean the opposite of quality. It might be wabi-sabi. It might be a humanity to it. That, you know, so when you saw Jon Stewart choking up last week when he was testifying before the Senate and the House, that was low quality and it was excellent work, right? Because he didn't finish his sentences. He got choked up in his words. So he didn't deliver the word properly, but it was remarkable. It got seen by millions of people. It made a difference to, because it was human, because it was great work. And so I think our obligation is to not be this sort of faux perfectionism of holding it back because it's not perfect, but instead say, this is important. And I'm going to do what's necessary to make it important.
Wabi-sabi, correct me if I'm wrong, is where is a Japanese art form where they sort of, do they deliberately break the pot and then glue it together with gold? Or does it
There is a thing, it starts with a K, I can never remember what that's called. Okay, so if you went to Japan in 1960 and said wabi-sabi, no one would know what you meant. It was actually a psychoanalyst in the United States, Leonard, I want to say his last name's Corin, wrote a book called Wabi Sabi, in which he conflated two words, wabi and sabi. And basically, I'm not doing a literal translation. One means death, and one means nature, and one implies handmade. It's the reality of use. And so a astroturfed lawn in the suburbs might be perfect, but a playground has wabi-sabi. you can see the footprints of the kids who came before you. The catcher's mitt that's brand new from the store is new, but a worn-in catcher's mitt is worth more because it has wabi-sabi. Mm-hmm. It's been there, and it's on its way to going away. And so, yes, there is a Japanese form of sculpture where you intentionally break a sculpture and then glue it together with gold to show that that's our lives, right? Our lives are nothing but our scars, our the things that didn't work out. And I treasure them. We each do. That my failures are more important to me than my successes, because it's my failures that made it so I could be here. That idea of wabi-sabi and humanity flies in the face of what happens when you see CBS make a 3-minute piece of video. You know, I was on CBS a couple weeks ago, really good people. There's only two of you here. There were five of them, and they were here for hours to make a 3-minute thing because they wanted to take out all the wabi-sabi. They wanted to be like, not that this really happened, but that this is a version of what happened.
Right.
And one of the reasons that Hollywood movies cost so much is that when you have an unlimited budget, you spend the last half of it taking out all the stuff that would make it look real.
Right. Yeah. Everything is, oh, that wasn't lit perfectly, or there was a, someone walked by outside. We have to get rid of that. And it's, well, yeah, we're in Seth's office, you know. Well, what's this? There's wires in the shot. Yeah, there are wires in the shot. There are wires in the office.
Exactly.
So, and people like that about podcasting, right? The wabi-sabi is there until there's just too much wabi that the everything else gets lost.
Exactly. I recorded my podcast in the bathroom right behind us here in the shower, and I lined it with some foam, and I just go in there and I hit record. And I have no staff other than Alex, who does the final edit for me, because I figured that's what people wanted from me.
To be clear, you're not actually taking a shower.
If you turn on the water, I don't know what would happen.
Right. That might be a little, yes, no more wabi-sabi at that point. More like
wet.
Wet.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Seth Godin. We'll be right back after this.
This episode is sponsored in part by Manscaped. Now, this was a product that I wasn't sure what to do with it. Well, I knew what to do with it.
I mean, I was going to say, it's right there on the tin. Come on.
It's literally called Manscaped. And I thought, okay, so this is what? Precision engineered tools for your family jewels. I think that's their slogan, which is kind of creative. I see what you did there. Now, this is delicate. You should handle this one delicately, right, Jason? Just like you would handle your junk. And they've got this electric trimmer that they've redesigned, right? A lot of us will go and shave. I should speak for myself. A lot of us will. We'll go and shave with a regular razor, and they've got, it's called, and I'm not even kidding, the Lawnmower 2.0, which has proprietary skin-safe technology, so it's not going to nick or snag your nuts, which I'm wondering if...
I will say that we were actually forced to read that, so we're not going on the fly here, but
that's
yes,
right.
It does have the skin-safe technology, so your taint is safe. With the lawnmower.
That's right. The lawnmower 2.0,
Lawnmower 2.0, yes.
Yeah. And plus, like, a lot of guys, they'll have a hair trimmer for their head, and they're like, ooh, do I want to use this down there? I'm not so sure about that.
I've lived with guys who trim their beard and their balls with the same little trimmer, and I'm like, please keep that on your side of the sink, dude, because that's just gross.
Well, also, you're just playing with fire. What happens when those blades get all, it pulls out a couple hairs, right? What happens when that happens down under? Not good at all. So I think it's good that this is specifically made for it. Also, they sent us a really nice, I mean, these came in, and I'm not going to lie, I was fairly surprised. Super high quality. The bag it came in was high quality. I actually, once I saw this, I requested one for you, for Gabriel, and for a couple other people here on the team. Did Fogarty get one?
Oh, yes, he did, and he has used it. And he said that the summer will be much cooler now, thanks to Manscaped.
Got it. Hashtag TMI. So anyway, let's tell him about the deal. I need a shower after this read, but Jason, tell him about the deal we got for him.
You can get 20% off and free shipping with code Jordan at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the code Jordan. And you get all sorts of goodies in here, too, like, which I love, the Crop Preserver, which is an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. So you got this is a full ball package that we're full ball court press you get here in the Manscaped bag.
It's funny. Stuff you didn't know you needed, right? Oh my goodness. All right. This episode is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. I love these guys. I can't believe this didn't exist earlier. I'm a big fan of therapy. You've heard me recommend it a lot on Feedback Friday, but I also I drink my own Kool-Aid, if you will. I eat my own dog food. That was what I was meaning to say. I love therapy. I think it's healthy. I think everyone should have it. Here's the thing. People go, oh, well, you know, I don't have anything. No, if you're sane, you need therapy to stay that way. Even if you just talk to somebody once a month, once a freaking quarter, seriously, it's worth it. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors, which is key. Don't be hiring some life coach thinking you're getting actual therapy. It's not the same. No hate on life coaches. I mean, a little, but they're not therapists. If you've got depression, stress, anxiety, relationship stuff, sleeping stuff, trauma stuff, anger stuff, all that self-esteem issues, all that huge list of stuff, that needs to be handled by a professional in order for you to stay productive, sane, healthy, etc. And I love that it's confidential, it's private, you can text, you can video chat. This is not driving across town, finding a parking space, making sure you got the appointment time right. This is go to your car during your lunch hour because you have 40 minutes, half hour, whatever, to do a session. That's what I'm talking about. That's 21st century therapy right there. Jason, we got a deal for him, right?
Of course we do. It's a truly affordable option for our listeners, and you get 10% off your first month with discount code Jordan, and you don't have to go sit in that waiting room and look at all the other people and then think about them judging you. You can just do it from the comfort of your own phone. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/Jordan. Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/Jordan.
This episode is also sponsored in part by Progressive.
Saving money on your car insurance is easy with Progressive. It's an average savings of $699 a year for customers who switch and save. In fact, customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts on their auto policy when they switch to Progressive. Discounts just for starting a quote online or owning multiple vehicles. Get your quote online at progressive.com and see how much you could be saving. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers keeps us on the air. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard so you can check out those amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget the worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And if you're listening to us on the Overcast player, please click that little star next to the episode. It really helps us out. And now for the conclusion of our episode with Seth Godin.
Let me tell you where I get a little discouraged. There are podcasts that talk about Real Housewives, what the host had for breakfast.
Yep.
She's drinking she's 3 glasses of wine deep when she does it. It has twice the audience that I have.
At least,
probably more like 5x. It's, you know, super profitable.
Sure.
And everyone's going, we want to buy ads on that one. But then there is an element of, well, not ads for things that maybe smart people would buy because they're not listening to that. But you'll never have better ratings than Jersey Shore or something that makes us all go, oh, and cringe, where the brands are paying the person to not wear the clothing.
Right.
Right.
If you A-B test a website enough, it will turn into a porn site.
Really?
Think about it.
Is that an experiment that actually was run?
So think about it. Because you have 2 ads. One ad has someone sort of unclothed. One ad doesn't, which is going to get more clicks. You have 2 things that people can do. One involves getting a short-term hit of endorphin. One doesn't. Like, bit by bit by bit, it's going to keep pushing you in a direction for a certain audience, right? Like, if you look, why is the spam from Nigeria so poorly written?
Deliberately filtering in people that would fall for it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it costs them a ton to get you to the next 6 steps of interaction. They don't want a smart person in the funnel because it's just going to break before they pay. They want dumb people in the funnel. And so the question I would ask you is, what's your goal? If your goal is to maximize the income from a podcast, then the quality you want is the dumbest, most prurient, short fix, quick hit thing you could come up with, because advertisers are obsessed with mass and perversely pay extra to reach large numbers of undifferentiated people when they should be paying less per head than that. They pay more per head, because they're lazy and traditional. So if that's the work you're proud of, this is the easiest thing in the world to do.
Right, it's not. It makes me want to take this pencil and push it as hard as I can.
I don't think you should, because you're comparing apples to oranges. That those people, what they really should be doing instead of a podcast is making a network TV show.
Mm-hmm.
They're failing too, because they only have 1/10 the reach they'd have on network TV. So it's a hierarchy, but it's not a ladder you want to be on. Instead, you're saying, for the people on a journey I care about, I can go with you over there. Who wants to come? And that's not the way to maximize your profit. The way to maximize your profit is go to work at Goldman Sachs. This is the way to maximize your impact on the people you seek to serve.
Do people come to you and say things like, how do I stay motivated to do what matters rather than what makes profit in the short term? Or is that a question you think that they should be able to answer on their own by existing?
I don't get asked that question. I don't do any consulting or coaching, so I don't get asked as many questions as you think.
Sure.
But the question I get asked much more often than that is, I have been moved by the muse to do X. I want Y and I'm not getting it. How dare the culture do that? How can I fix it?
Right.
That sense of entitlement happens constantly. And the answer is, what made you think that X and Y were related? You're entitled to do X. You're not entitled to get Y. That there might be a disconnect between the X you're doing and the Y you think you're entitled to get. And it's that but, that and, that is getting in the way of your joy. I can tell you how to get that kind of output, but you won't be able to do the kind of art you say you want to do. You'll have to do something for them. And what I write about in This Is Marketing is most marketers say, I have a key. Show me the lock it fits.
Mm.
That's a really dumb way to get into a house.
Yeah.
The smart way is to say, here's a lock. Why don't you go make a key that will open that? That makes much more sense. That is a service mindset built on empathy to say, I'm not going to force you to change for me to serve you. I'm going to go to who you are and where you are going and bring you something that you know you need.
What advice would you have for somebody who, as you put it in, is it the Icarus Deception? I always mess this title up.
That's the name of the book.
Yeah. Yes. Did it have another title, or was there just a misprint in an article that was big that had the title wrong? Or
am I just... In my head, it had another title, but in real life, it never had another title.
What was the title that was in your head?
I don't remember.
Okay. Maybe I heard it on a podcast or something, because it is just polluting my brain. What advice would you have for people who fly too low, right? Because there's people who are making things that think, this doesn't matter. There's too much noise. No one cares about deeper thought anymore. That person might be me. Maybe I'm using you as my therapist right now. But in a way, right? Because there's people who are going, oh, why make smart content when everyone's dumb? Which is not necessarily true, but it can feel that way.
So once you make that statement, is your next statement, all right, I'll make dumb content?
But you don't really want to, right?
Well, so now we're back to the, I want to do what I want to do, but I'm not getting what I want to do.
Right, right.
You know, the number of blog posts I've written that have won the internet is zero. 7,400 blog posts, and I have never had one go super viral. And that is totally fine with me. In fact, I know how to write one of those blog posts. I don't want to write one of those blog posts, because if I did, I'd get hooked on that and I'd have to do it again.
Sure.
And so I'm flattered when people look to me as a big success, except authors that I really respect, the Liz Gilberts and the Malcolm Gladwells, the world sell 20 times as many books as I do. 20 times. And I don't have 20 times the podcast listeners you do. 20x is a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah.
And if I was going to focus on that, it would be foolish, because if I want to go be Liz Gilbert, I should figure out how to be Liz Gilbert. And then maybe I'll get what Liz Gilbert gets. But there already is a Liz Gilbert. I should just be me and figure out how to organize my overhead so that what I'm getting for being me can sustain me to do it again. That doesn't mean you don't try to do outreach that's appropriate. You don't try to find leverage and a social ratchet and learn how to do that kind of marketing. It just means you don't do it with a chip on your shoulder.
Right.
Because the world, this idea that you're entitled to X because you put the effort in, you just got to go to the floors of museums with artists you never heard of. Painting after painting from people you never heard of. Go to the record store of records after. They're just as good. They're just not famous.
Right. Right. And it's easy to go, but I've been doing this for 12 years. I should. And I always have to check myself on that, because when I look at people will say, your YouTube should be bigger. And I go, yeah. So what would you do? And you talk to the expert and they go, oh, you know, you need like a snazzy explosion in thumbnail. And it has to say, this quote blew my head up when Seth said it. And then people will click and then they'll go, my head's not exploding. This is dumb. But then you get more subscribers.
You've created trust for attention.
Right. You're optimizing for dumbness.
And so magazines that I used to respect now have headlines like, this one thing United Airlines did will blow your mind.
Right.
Well, okay, I clicked once, but I'm never coming back.
Right.
And so in the long run, we've seen it again and again and again. In the long run, you can trade for attention, but you can't trade for trust.
I think that's a really good point. You see websites that were once the preeminent whatever magazine, and now it's called a click farm, and they're not really exaggerating.
Right, exactly.
And you can turn your work into that if you're not careful by going, wow, look, when I put more cleavage on Instagram, well, maybe not for me or you, but some people can do that and they'll get more followers. But then are you getting people that want to buy your floral arrangements? Are you getting people that want to hear your opinion on something? No, you're getting
emojis. This is the debate we have in the office every day, right? I don't use Instagram the way I'm supposed to. I don't use Twitter the way I'm supposed to. And I don't use Facebook the way I'm supposed to. And I'm aware of that. But my job is not to make Mark Zuckerberg happy. My job is to work with the people who want to go on this journey with me. And if using a social media outlet the way that will make the CEO happy will undermine what I'm trying to do, then I don't want to do it. I'm also not doing a particularly good job making Barnes & Noble happy, right? Fine. That's not my job.
You turned down this $1 billion in stock options. Was that for Yoyodyne or was that
for No. After I sold Yoyodyne, I was at Yahoo. And Bill Gross, the guy who invented so many things on the internet that he doesn't always get credit for, including Google's business model, ran a company called Idealab. And Idealab was the next hot thing. It was going to be a multi. Steven Spielberg was on the board, was the real deal. And Bill called me up right around the time I was thinking of leaving Yahoo. And he said, we'd love to have you be the chief marketing officer for Idealab. We're going public in 6 months. And there's $1 billion in stock options in it. And I said, no. And it doesn't matter that the internet bubble burst in between the two. I'm sort of sad it didn't. It would have been great if it really was worth $1 billion. Because the magic for me was I never again had to say, I got to do something for money.
Right.
Because I turned down $1 billion.
Right.
Great.
So why sell out for $100,000?
Exactly. Done.
Yeah.
And my life has been better ever since.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. That's my follow-up to that was, what did that teach you about doing things for money? Because, yeah, if you're going to... I used to be a Wall Street attorney. My bonus check was supposed to be as big as my annual revenue is for this, but I would not... We would not be... You'd be talking to one miserable guy, or not at all,
right,
at this point. And I can see that. I can see that being almost liberating. Like, look, if I didn't sell out for that, there's not really an amount of money that's going to make me then change my principles.
Exactly.
Or make crappy work.
But I also have a lot of other principles about industriousness and forward motion that make me work way harder than I would work if I was just seeking to maximize profit.
How do we know what feedback to listen to? Because we're getting a lot. Whenever our work is out there, we're getting a whole lot of feedback. Some of it's unsolicited. And I like to improve my show or whatever. People like to improve their writing, their work based on feedback. But there's a YouTube comment that says, I don't like your purple glasses. And then there's different types of people that might love them or not comment on your glasses at all, because that's not the freaking point.
Exactly.
How do we really know, when it's not such an obvious example, who to listen to?
So I just recorded a whole podcast about this very topic. So I'm going to try not to repeat myself too much, but here we go. The most important thing to remember is a simple sentence. It's not for you. That if someone gives you a piece of feedback that indicates what kind of person they are by the nature of the feedback. So you run an Indian restaurant on 6th Street in New York and you have a $24 spicy vindaloo. If you finish it, you get it for free. It's that spicy. And someone comes to the restaurant and says, I hate spicy food. It's really obvious what you should do. And it's not take it off the menu. It's say to that person, Veselka, Ukrainian food, is 2 blocks from here. Nothing in the restaurant is spicy. Here's their phone number. Thanks for stopping by. What I sell is not for you. Being able to do that is hugely powerful. So if I look at, you know, the 100 most beloved books ever written, all of them have more one-star reviews on Amazon than any book I've ever written. All of them. Because if you're going to write To Kill a Mockingbird or Harry Potter, a lot of people are going to read it. And if a lot of people are going to read it, some of them need to say, it's not for me. And the way they do that is by writing a one-star review. Mm-hmm. But Harper Lee shouldn't have read her one-star reviews because it's not going to make her a better writer tomorrow. All it says is, I don't like spicy food. Mm-hmm. Like, good luck to you. So that's the most important thing. Do not go looking for these one-star reviews because they will not help you do better work. And it's in our instinct, people like us, to go look for the one-star reviews because we want to put ourselves in the state of angry underdog again, mm-hmm. beating ourselves up, thinking that that's the fuel for our best work. And I'm not sure that's true.
It's like you see me, Seth. How do you know I do that every single morning? Yeah, there's a part of that.
I haven't read an Amazon review in 7 years.
That's probably wise, yeah. I think looking for like a 3-star, that's where sometimes you get value. Not always, though, right? Maybe more like the email that's 3 paragraphs that comes.
Emails feels very different to me.
Yeah.
Because email isn't in public, so the person's not trying to raise their status in the hierarchy. Email's not anonymous, right? And email has a history. So if I've never heard from you before, and you write about a blog post I just wrote, that's negative, I'm going to ignore you. But if in the 145,000 emails I've answered through the years, I've seen you float by now and then, questioning something, asking about something, and then you send me a note, mm-hmm. that feels really different to me.
Sure.
Right? So like one of the things I learned is people in Australia don't like it when you say it's summer and it's hot. Because it's winter in Australia right now. So they feel left out. So I now say, for people in the Northern Hemisphere, right, or whatever, because I want to acknowledge, right, how did I come to know this? I came to know this because several people I trust, who I'd been back and forth, who I've never met, like, you know what? We prefer it if you do this. I'll listen to that. Mm-hmm. That's advice. That's not feedback.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's hard to remember in the moment, but it's worth revisiting that, especially if you find yourself at 2 o'clock in the morning scrolling through your most critical reviews on whatever platform you do.
And also, as long as we're talking about what's true as opposed to what's emotional, if I said to the two of you guys, name the greatest jazz album of all time.
Oh, I don't know.
Maybe Kind of Blue, Miles Davis.
Yeah, I was going to say some John Coltrane or Miles Davis. Right. Yeah.
So Kind of Blue, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, 5 days, beginning to end. Got the idea, 5 days later, it's completely done. So if Miles Davis, and then you can, if you listen carefully, you'll hear their mistakes. You'll hear their notes that are not perfectly in tune. If Miles Davis can make one of the greatest jazz albums of all time in 5 days, why is what you're doing so hard? Or another question, how long would it take you to type a 150-page book? Well, if you know how to type, you could probably type it in 4 days. So why does it take a year? It's not the typing. It's the getting out of your way part. Mm-hmm. Miles got out of his way. That you can write a book. I wrote The Dip in 2 weeks. You can write a book if you get out of your way. So the work here is not that you have to get network standard and practices and the A&R people to say, mm-hmm. yes, we will put you in the store. And you don't need to get Tower Records to give you shelf space because they're all gone. You can publish anything you want. So the work is find the people you seek to serve. Bring them a true, honest version of the change you seek to make. And then let it happen. Don't obsess about the one-star reviews. Learn what you need to learn from good advice. And do it again.
I've heard you say things that indicate that you're not a fan of hustling, so to speak.
For sure.
I hate that word even because I think that the whole internet is full of hustle porn, as I call it.
Yep.
There's whole bodies of work that are just to motivate people to, I don't even know, stand on a beach and do this or something. Can you elaborate on why?
Hustle is selfish. It's selfish. Hustle says, how do I create enough reciprocity debt plus close talking, plus promises that are hard to keep, so that someone will let me go forward rather than doing the difficult work of saying no. That's a hustle, right? So you can get hustled by a life insurance salesperson. You can get hustled at the car dealership. You can get hustled at the bus station in New York City. That so, it's not bullying, but it's in the same category. That, you know, one of the hustle things that went around a couple of years ago is one way to hustle somebody is engage with them a little bit and then ask for a favor.
Mm.
So email, hey, Seth, what's your favorite color?
Yeah.
Right? You write back, say, oh, really? My favorite color is yellow. Will you blurb my book? Right?
That it drives me absolutely. You know, the worst is, Jordan, I'm a huge fan of your work. This thing really changed my life. And I'm like, oh, I'm having a good read here. This is a really, would you? And then I go, oh, so this was, you're just buttering me up. Or, now I feel
dumb. It's
not
even buttering. You're trying to create an environment where I will feel worse by saying no.
Mm-hmm.
That's hustling. Because it's nothing generous. It's nothing that you would do if you weren't going to get something in return.
Right.
It's something risky on your part. Like sometimes people will say, I'm taking a big risk here. I'm asking you for so-and-so. What exactly is your risk?
Right.
There is no risk. What you're doing is trading favors and working your way up ladder after ladder so that in a hurry, you can hustle your way up. And it has never been easier and more socially acceptable to hustle. And my point is, hustle is different than what that other word hustle means, which is the hockey player who always skates a little bit harder, mm-hmm. the hockey player who always practices a little bit longer. We also call that hustle. That hustle is fine because you're doing it in service of supporting your team, not because you're trying to trick your way forward. And I think that when we ask most people, would you like to be hustled?
Right.
They would say no. And if that's really the case, then I'm going to propose to people that they have a better way forward than hustling people.
You advocate often for taking this long-term approach versus the short-term approach. And that's for a lot of people, I think they really love this. When it comes to investing money or investing in yourself or a business, generally it's a good idea. It's more scarce these days, which I think is an opportunity. But I wonder how you or we would go about persuading people to take the long-term journey instead of just what's going to work short-term. Speaking of hustling, right?
Yeah, I guess I still come back to, well, what is it that you're hoping for?
Ideally, a fulfilling career,
well,
right?
So if you're trying to get to Cleveland, don't head south.
How much you live in Michigan.
Right? Because right. It's not going to head you in that direction. I've spent some time recently talking to 18, 19-year-olds who are trying to move their way up. And they are surrounded by images that say, $1 million by 22 or bust.
The hustle porn. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, those people, show me what happened to them when they turned 30. Where are they now? Because if the trajectory was a straight line, they'd be Warren Buffett by the time they're 30. They're not. What happened between 22 and 30? And what you see is these people are signed up for an endless cycle of boom and bust. And they have to constantly engage with new people because they've burned all the old ones. If that's what you want, go model them. Leave me alone. But if you want the other path, start living the other path. Take a look at how long it took for someone to do it and do it and do it. And the stories never end, right? I want to be Amanda Palmer. Well, Amanda wrote down exactly how to be Amanda Palmer. Mm-hmm. It does not involve one day Oprah called me and then I was Amanda Palmer. That's never the story.
Waiting for that phone call from Oprah. But Seth, in the meantime, I know we'd said 55. We are at 55 and 5 seconds.
You're amazing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Great big thank you to Seth Godin. We're going to link to a bunch of his books here in the show notes. And we're teaching you how to connect with great people like Seth. Reach out to people that you admire, keep relationships going with people that you've known for years, and reignite those old relationships that you've let lapse. It's a free course on how to do this over at jordanharbinger.com/course. I literally have nothing to sell you. I kind of wish that I did, but in the meantime, this is all free. I don't plan on making it not free, but no promises there. I would love to hear what you think about this. A lot of people don't dig the well before they get thirsty, and they find out the hard way when they need relationships. So ignore this at your own peril. JordanHarbinger.com/course is where you can find that. And most of the guests here on the show, they subscribe to the course and the newsletter. So come join us. It's a bunch of successful people. It's not sort of one of those bottom rung, scrape the bottom of the barrel type of things. This is skills that successful people use. Not just introverts, not just people who don't know how to send an email. I'd love to hear what you think about it because you all are pretty damn smart from my experience. Speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from Seth Godin. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram, and there's a video of this interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. Speaking of feedback, of course, I do read everything, especially reviews on Apple Podcasts. Even if you don't use the app, I'd love to see a review from you. It's a great way to let other people know how to find the show. And if you need instructions on how to do that, because Apple sure don't make it easy, go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe and we'll show you how. This show is produced in association with Podcast One, and this episode was co-produced by Jason DeFilippo and Jen Harbinger. Show notes and worksheets by Robert Fogarty. Music by Evan Viola. And I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Our advice and opinions and those of our guests are their own. Do your own research before implementing anything you hear on the show. And remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which should be in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time. A lot of people ask me which podcasts I listen to and recommend. I've been friends with Pat Flynn of Smart Passive Income for years now. And Pat, thanks for joining us. You had a really interesting episode recently about why people really hate us online. And of course, you hear all these cliches like, oh, if you're not getting haters, you're not doing it right. And it's like, okay, maybe that's the reason. Also, there are other reasons, like some people are just horrible. But what are some of the conclusions you came up with in episode 372?
Yeah, this has actually become one of my most popular episodes recently. And it stems from, and the reason I created this is because my son, who's 9, started a YouTube channel. And he got a really hateful comment from some random person on his video. And the comment was, this is to a 9-year-old kid, by the way, it was, kill yourself.
That's so horrible.
Yeah. And thankfully, my wife and I, we had sort of taught our son to look out for this and to understand why people are like that. And what we taught him and what we try to teach people in this episode is that hurt people. Right? People do this, and it's not usually a reflection on you. It's usually a reflection on something that's happening in their life. And I go into a lot of examples beyond the one with my son, but my own personal examples being an online entrepreneur and having a following online on very similar situations. And thankfully, my son was big enough to go, wow, I hope this person's okay, instead of going, oh my gosh, like, my content is crap, or I should stop doing this, or, you know, or the worst thing possible, obviously. And we're thankful that we're able to teach him at a young age. And we just wanted to, in this episode, talk about hate online in a very honest way and hopefully have you realize that, you know, hurt people, they hurt people. And it's not about you, it's about them.
That was an interesting point that I had to figure out on my own. I mean, doing a podcast, being online at all for 13 years, I don't know about you, but I've seen, not online at all, but being in the, if you can even call it, the limelight of influencer, whatever the hell you want to call it, I've found that over the last 13 years, it's gotten much worse. It used to be there was the occasional crazy person, but they were actually so obviously mentally unstable. And there were some jerks online. But now it almost seems like there's a huge number of people that are really, really negative. And it sort of speaks to more people being online in general. But it also seems like more people being online to vent about their life or something. I don't know. I'm interested to hear what you think about that. So I'll check out 372 of Smart Passive Income with Pat Flynn.